Just above 3.5.
Now, we'd been doing some shipboard routine on HMS Bullen, but what I want to do now is go back to when you first joined them, because that was in mid-March, and almost immediately, I believe, you were joining escort group B6, and almost immediately you were sent off on a convoy on the St. Patrick's Day, 17th of March. It's a Newfoundland, yeah. Now, what can you take us through this when you this first early bit and
terrible, absolutely terrible. The ship was still working up, and in addition, I personally had no experience of Royal Navy ship routine, and indeed ship life, and of course the March was not particularly good, whether to go sailing or yachting, and we were stuck in the Atlantic for, I think it was something like 10 days to go across the Newfoundland at something like 6 to 8 knots, because as everybody tells you, that the speed of the convoy is the speed of the slowest ship, and quite a lot of those ships were quite slow, and most of them, I would imagine, were going across fairly light. You know, the amount of number of goods they were carrying was probably very light in respect of exports, but the object of the ship going on was to pick up much-needed armaments and various things for the war.
How long was it before you settled down into the routine? We've discussed some of the routine, but
yes. I think you settle down in the routine fairly quickly, because I've been in the Navy since December 1942, and you got into the habit of accepting the situation and looking for the routine as a matter of subconscious satisfaction, mental satisfaction. So that was in itself all right, but of course the continuous seasickness, for example, in the bad weather was a bit of a strain. But I didn't eat that much for the first few days, and walked around when I was on watch with a bucket. And I wasn't the only one, quite a lot of people were suffering.
How bad did it make you feel? I mean, how bad was it? The seasickness. No, the seasickness.
Oh, quite bad, yes. Although I wasn't quite as bad as other people. One signalman was in the front most of the time we were on that trip out. But, and of course the weather was bad. You were constantly to action stations when there was a suspect sub around.
Did you get any messages on your HFDF that I presume you'd be picking up lots of messages, but was there any particular incidents you recall?
I don't remember on that one, no. On that one, I don't know, across there, no.
It says nothing happened on the way out.
No. I do remember that the thing that I'd seen was these carriers, merchant ships have been converted to carriers, escort carriers, and they fired airplanes off. And I always wondered how the hell they'd gone back again, because you can't fly an airplane back almost to anything. And in fact, I did actually see one of them going to the sea trying to land. And I gather that what they actually did was to, as a routine, they had a large crane on the side of the ship and try and maneuver alongside the airplane and pick it up out of the water.
Now, on the way back, anything happened there? Were you long at St. John's, or Newfoundland?
A few days, at the most.
Anything happen?
No, it's an interesting thing that Steve might have not mentioned to you. Going into St. John's, well, of course, the first thing you notice about North Atlantic is when you get up south of Iceland and Greenland, there's an awful lot of ice about on the water, like ice floes. And I'd never seen that sort of thing before. I found that quite interesting. In fact, I took some photographs of it. But going into St John's, the entrance to St John's Harbour is like a canyon with houses built on each side up the side of the cliff. And you go in the middle. Well, Steve was quite sharp about this, and he asked the navigating officer later on how he did it. And he pointed out that we went in on a radio beacon. So it was quite interesting really to do that. And then, of course, when we got into St John's, there were quite a few Canadian corvettes. Very little else.
Did you get ashore?
Yes, oh yes.
What do you remember of that?
Steak and egg and chips. Up in the forces canteen, which was up the top of the hill. And lots of snow. Of course, there were cigarettes, cheap cigarettes, candles and that kind of thing. So really, a relaxation of the austere food regime that one would have had during the war.
Now, on the way back, there was a bit more trouble. There was a submarine, a tanker sunk, or had to be sunk, damaged, in a U-boat attack. But it seems to mention the Goodall in connection with this, rather than the Bullen. Were you aware of this going on?
Probably, yeah. Yeah, probably would know it. I would know about it, yeah. I know we did lose ships, a convoy covers quite a few miles. And if you were doing, a tail end Charlie, you could be about 10 miles away from the front end of the convoy.
What was it like, the convoy, to see? I mean, what was convoy discipline like and routine like?
Generally, considering most of these people were merchant navy crews, I would imagine, I would say that it was quite good. But there were the odd stragglers, people who got trouble, engine trouble and things like that. And when that happened, we were usually detailed off to go and look after them, stand by. Because they were sitting ducks, you see. So we provide an ASDIC, and the HFDF protection until they could get going and we could get back into the combat. But if that happened to be the slowest ship of the convoy, you didn't have a hope in hell of getting back with the convoy, because they were probably speed. But a little bit faster, you see. But you wanted the Commodore, want to get the convoy in under the screen as long as early as possible, so you wouldn't wait around for a lone ship.
And according to the book, they went back to Liverpool. We got him back to Liverpool on the 13th of April, according to.
Bullen did, from that convoy. That's probably true, yes. I don't think we landed up. We went to Mobile, which was Lough Foyle from Londonderry. On the way in, we did it on the way out, actually, I think. So we would go from Liverpool to Lough Foyle, and we might spend a couple of days there, preparatory to a group having a meeting there, and there'll be one or two Canadian ship there as well.
Did you get ashore at all? They were in Gladstone Dock in Liverpool. Yes. Did you get ashore?
Yes. Oh, yes.
What was Liverpool like?
Yes. Quite good, actually. It's lively, although there was blackout, but there were quite a few places to the cinema open, and the transport system there seemed to be quite good. They had this overhead railway running that used to have it along the seafront, along the dock end.
You were in Gladstone Dock, weren't you?
Gladstone Dock, which is the one furthest north from the Mersey. It's not there now, I don't know. No, is it? I think it is. No, it isn't. It's been built on. So that one actually doesn't exist.
And what about the local people? Did they make you welcome, or...?
Well, no more than I would expect anywhere else, you know, just because there were quite a lot of Navy ships and merchant ships there. But we always had a friendly welcome with the girls, So life wasn't bad.
Now the next trip that it mentions in the book is a trip to Iceland, to Reykjavik, as an independent unit, not the whole of B6, which is only three ships anyway.
There were two of us.
You and Goodall.
Yes. We were escorting a troop ship. Anyway, it's one of the P&O liners.
SS Cameronia?
It might have been, but I thought it was Orion or something like that at one time. I think we went to Iceland another time, and we went up to Helsingfjord to an American air base.
Now, when you were the first time, anything happened while you were escorting the troop ship?
No, I don't remember anything. Apart from being buzzed by two Buffalo American airplanes, that was all. So they come out to just confirm that the sick, presumably they got a blip on the radar and they want to make sure that it was a friendly or otherwise.
And were you used to shipboard routine by this time?
By that time, yes. Yes. Well in fishing over the side and that sort of thing.
Did you do much fishing, or was that just in port? Or?
Well, only in Reykjavik, because the nights at that time, that would probably be the end of May, probably mid-May, and the days were getting long, so it never actually got dark, you see. And the water's very clear, and you could see, quite a long way down. You get an optical effect. But yes, we did quite well fishing in the harbour.
And then
shortly as well.
What was that like?
Not very hospitable. The best thing was looking at the girls coming in from the other villages on the boats, over on the ferry boats.
Some people have said that the Icelanders were pretty anti-British at the time. Were you aware of that, do you think, or was it just not very hospitable? It's a difference.
Well, I suppose, they probably weren't as friendly as the Canadians were, which is their, and the, we weren't, even the Northern Ireland people weren't that friendly. I have no real criticism. I might have sensed the sort of standoffishness, but then you're looking at a different nationality, ex-Danes, I suppose.
And then you escort, just before D-Day, you seem to have gone to meet a convoy at 30 degrees out. I don't know, close escort duty in late-ish May. Back to Belfast. Do you recall that at all?
Now that's late May. Now June 6th was D-Day.
That's the next thing after that.
Yeah. We'll come back to that.
Well, let's go to June the 6th then, because tell me what you were doing there, because that is interesting.
Well, June the 6th was D-Day, and it was actually 24 hours. Earlier than it was supposed to have happened. So we were in Plymouth, and probably on about the night of the 4th, and we were detailed off to go and supervise a tug, I suppose, to carry in the Maverick Cassium, which had broken away from the tug in very, very bad weather. So I remember us doing that, and that was, I suppose that was the day before D-Day, or 2 days before, in that intervening period when it was put off for 24 hours, I think, or 48 hours, which, it's just a lump of concrete floating in the Atlantic, so it was a hazard. And, if somebody wanted to be certain that it was marked. Now, I'm not quite sure what happened after we marked it, or whether the tug got tow on, and then we left. But what we actually did on D-Day was to escort either the Nelson or the Rodney to a bombardment of, we thought we were told, Brest. But we were actually told, I was told, that it was the Nelson, but I think...
Says Nelson. Says Nelson, yeah.
Well, I've done this, some research, if this is of any interest, at the Public Record Office, and also queried the Admiralty, and the signals and the record don't confirm that it's the Nelson. They say that the Nelson at that time was stowed in harbour, and it was probably a lookalike, which was Rodney, I think.
And what exactly were you doing? You went out with Rodney to Brest, did you?
Well, I think we must have come from Plymouth again and joined that with Rodney coming down the Western Approaches. And I think we were in convoy with, or in company with, probably Goodall. And we had one in advance of the ship you were escorting and one behind, giving a radar and ASDIT cover. And then we watched the bombardment take place, but you couldn't see what it was aiming at because it was so far away. You could just see the coastline, you know where you were, unless you were a navigator, so that you knew whereabouts in the world you were. But these 15-inch guns, something I don't forget.
And then you were sent off to do an anti-submarine sweep.
We did a large sweep, didn't we, in the Western Approaches, yes. I remember doing that.
What do you remember of that?
Well, it's like all the others. It's just from their point of view, it's just just doing a sweep back and forth in a rectangular area. Unless you pick up something, your routine wouldn't be brought to action stations or anything like that, so rather just carry on. You're rolling around at about 8 knots or something like that.
How did you find the rolling? I mean, did you get used to it? Did the seasickness go away? But they did roll very badly.
It didn't go away, but you got used to the motion. I mean, if you got a change of weather, you've noticed that, it's a lot better today, isn't it? But when the weather broke again, off you went, you see, and the seasickness come with you. And it wasn't just being sick, it made you, it was depressing as well, I think.
And they then had this, the second trip to Iceland, escorting SS Highland Princess, which may or may not, anything, nothing to add about that.
No, I don't. But I know we went to a different spot at that time, which I thought was Helsingfjord, which is up one of the fjords in a small town up an inlet. And I don't think we went ashore there. Because sometimes, if you were taking something up, if it wasn't a ship, we were going up on our own. Or if for some reason it was staying, we would come away again.
Now, in July, you were acting as tenders to the escort carrier Vindex during anti-submarine patrols, more of these sweeps. And this might be when you were thinking of the escort carriers in particular. There were quite a few contacts and depth charge dropping and the rest of it, off Rock Isle and the rest of it, but no submarines. So do you remember any particular incidents during this, any contacts you got or any close submarine messages you took?
No, not my, I didn't take any, no. Not that I can remember, anyway. I'm sure I didn't get a V-bar. But I remember there was a lot of depth charge activity. And I think at one time we dropped depth charges when there were people in the water. probably from the Senate ship.
Did that upset the crew, or did you really?
I suppose, I think there was one or two moans about it, but it's one of those sort of things that you've got to do, I suppose. So I think most people understood that it's the task of the ship is to sink submarines or sink U-boats.
And then late July, another trip to Iceland with the SS Otranto. Probably nothing.
Otranto.
That was the one. And then a convoy to Gibraltar in August through September. What do you remember about the convoy to Gibraltar?
Very good, very nice. Everybody was quite pleased about that. First of all, when we got out of the Bay of Biscay, the weather improved. But in fact, we got out alongside Brest, and the weather improved almost immediately because it was summer, wasn't it? It was July, wasn't it, when we did that?
Even later, August through to September.
And the sea's glass and took us about a week or 10 days to get down there, I suppose. And then there was 3 or 4 days in Gibraltar with plenty of food and plenty to do and bananas. I took a photograph myself. Have you seen that one? With bananas, it was quite interesting, quite good. Makes a change.
Now, when you got back, you went back to Belfast after that. Apparently you had this is when you joined the 19th Escort Group. Did that make a difference joining that? That was under the Hesperus, that was the senior officer's ship, and Lochinch, Antigua, and Anguilla, besides yourself.
No,
and the good
I think it was the normal. I didn't know, we changed groups until I noticed that we've got a different leader. And you only know the leader when you started the flags, and the flag changes, you see. So you've then got a different leader's flag up.
And what about, there were some training exercises between the groups, sort of almost working up as a group. Do you recall any of that you did?
Well, I probably, from my point of view, it would be the this radio contact that one would have to undertake. Now, whether that they got us to do that at that time, because normally you kept radio silence unless you actually had to, as part of the routine to make somebody aware of submarines in the air. And we never transmitted, for example, on the normal wavelength. If
you were just receiving.
Well, even the radio remote, the WT operators never transmitted. They only received. And I'm not sure how they got information back, but somehow they must have. Perhaps they had a set routine. But I didn't think they had. I didn't. And I certainly never transmitted, except when we got the B-bar sub.
And that's when you.
Yeah, it's the only time we.
Do you remember any time, any particular time when you got the B-bar?
Well, two times, I think. Twice.
When were they? Was it difficult to pin down in?
No, I've got an idea that one of them was on that trip to Gibraltar, actually, because in my mind I've got it as being somewhere off the Bay of Biscay, and we never went down there apart from Western approaches when we went to look for this Cassian, and we escorted the battleship to bombard the French coast. But I thought we were much further south than that, and we only went down jib once, I think.
And what happened when you received the signal?
Well, some days later, we were told that the signal that I'd picked up and activated was about 600 miles away. But it was a very, very good signal, strong and constant.
And what was the second time that you, or the other time you got a B bar? That's okay. Now, another thing, it was in November in the Clyde, you did these HFDF calibrations. Now, off tape, you told me a bit about them. Yeah. If you could just tell us what that was exactly.
If it was an HFDF calibration only, then we would be determining the accuracy of the equipment we were receiving with respect to the angle from which we were receiving the radio signal.
So how did they do that?
Well, in the case of an earlier type of HFDF set, you would have a goniometer system where you tune in your antennas to receive a signal matching the intensity, and then read off the angle on the compass pole that's the electrical device that determines the strength of the signal. And then you'd have to sense whether it was coming from forward of you or behind of you, you see. Now, in the case of the system I had, which was a FH4X, it was a cathode ray tube display where it produced an oscilloscope type trace, an ellipse. And you read off the angle on a calibrated rim, in the rim being calibrated in degrees. Now, when the ship was being calibrated, they would cause a radio transmitter to circle the ship on a small boat. And this, as I said earlier, on this was a rather fine yacht, a steam yacht, and it was about a half mile long, I suppose. And it could be, it should be further, but you know, within the confines of static conditions, you generally find you can't get further away. So the ship would go around two or three times, and you would note the angle at which you were, your device was giving a certain reading relative to a hooter or some very audible sound, a bleep on a hooter or something like that. And you would then compare the angle of the vessel from the ship and the angle that your instrument described at the same point. And you do that every 10 degrees, I suppose.
And what about, you mentioned also they did the compass calibrations.
The compass calibration is exactly the same way, except that the reading off the visual sighting of the ship, the transmitting ship, against the relative zero of the needle. You know, on a compass, the bowl rotates in alcohol, and in fact the whole thing's very well general. So they will compare the visual sight with the angle that the ship was appearing at through the observation bar.
And then how did they adjust the compass? You mentioned that.
Well, then on the binnacle, which is the device that supports the compass on the weather bridge, that's the most uppermost bridge, there are two brackets, one on each side, on the port and starboard side, which support large cast iron balls. And you move these in and out to give you a correction of an error that may have been caused by putting the compass on the ship. I mean, when you build a ship, there's an inherent magnetic field, and that system is aimed at trying to give you a bit of correction.